like what Oregon made with Measure 110.
Dr. Saurabh, thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure speaking with you. It's been a lot of fun.
I've been speaking with Michael Saurabh, PhD, a data scientist in New York City and lead author of an article published September 5th in the journal JAMA Network Open entitled Drug Decriminalization, Fentanyl and Fatal Overdoses in Oregon. Reporting for KABU News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
You're listening to KABU News and Review. I'm Chris Gao. This episode is focused on health and healthcare. KABU is currently in our Catalog of Connections drive, so help us out with a donation. Go online to kabu.fm/give. Health and wellness also has a lot to do with our environment, and this summer Oregon and Southwest Washington got a couple of heat waves, made all the more intense by something called the urban heat island effect. Here's our story.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's hot out. You know it. I know it. As much as it's been recognized that the human-caused climate crisis is contributing to higher temperatures and heat waves, our built environment can do the same, especially in cities. It's called the urban heat island effect, which basically means that cities experience much warmer temperatures than nearby rural areas do. But just how much of an impact does this effect have, and how is it connected to the environment in different neighborhoods? Climate Central looked at this question in new research released on July 10th. Across the country, they looked at 65 major cities and estimated how much hotter it gets than baseline in different neighborhoods because of what residents have built there. Of the 50 million people included in the analysis, 68% lived in an area with an urban heat island index of 8 degrees or more. So when the forecast says it's going to be 80 degrees, people experience a temperature of 88 degrees in those neighborhoods. In Portland specifically, 60,000 people live in parts of the city that have a UHI index of 9 degrees or more. But what exactly are the factors that make different neighborhoods hotter? The first one is called albedo. Here's the MIT Concrete Sustainability Hub to explain.
If you've ever walked barefoot on pavement in the summer sun, you probably know how burning hot it can get. This phenomenon, as it turns out, is more than just a nuisance. It actually has a dramatic impact on our daily lives, from the Earth's climate to human health. We refer to it as albedo. Here's how it works. Solar radiation constantly enters the atmosphere, where it is either absorbed or reflected by the Earth's surface. While the energy that is absorbed stays and warms the Earth, the reflected energy travels back to the atmosphere, some of which is returned to space. Albedo is a measure of this reflected radiation. The higher the albedo, the more energy is reflected, and the lower the albedo, the more energy is absorbed. We can actually measure the magnitude of albedo, in large part due to color. Lighter colored surfaces reflect more radiation, which we perceive as light, and have a higher albedo. On the other hand, darker surfaces absorb more light and have a lower albedo. So what impact does albedo have on our lives? When sunlight hits a city, dark man-made surfaces on pavements and roofs absorb this energy and begin to heat up. This warms surrounding areas throughout the day and long after the sun sets.
There are two other factors that influenced the urban heat island index too, along with albedo. The percentage of green space makes a difference. Plants help cool the air through a process called evapotranspiration, and less vegetation means less cooling. If you've spent any hot summer days in the forest, you may have felt the difference. Plants can help reduce peak summer temperatures in cities between 2 and 9 degrees, one study found. The other big factor is population density. Lots of human activities create extra heat. Think transportation, industrial facilities, and cooling down buildings. So sun-absorbing surfaces like roads, less green space, and high population density contribute to higher temperatures in urban areas. It's worth noting that extreme heat is the deadliest weather-related hazard in the U.S., so tackling urban heat islands could really make a difference as our weather gets more extreme because of the climate crisis. To learn more about this research, I spoke with Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central. Thank you for being here. So we're talking about your new analysis of urban heat islands. Talk me through this, sort of the basic top line stuff here. What was it that you sought to measure in this work?
All right. Well, we focus on climate change. And a lot of times climate change is confused with urban heat islands, and they're separate. And so we wanted to really kind of distinguish between the two. The fact that there's baseline temperatures going up everywhere, whether you're in a city or not in a city. But in the city, there's an additional risk because temperatures are warmer in the city, basically because of two really broad things, which are the built environment, buildings, streets, and population density. So all the heat we produce living every day. And so we wanted to put some measures on that so people could see what the, you know, the estimated additional risk was for people in different cities, and maybe provide a guide for folks to know what neighborhoods and what areas of the city might be most at risk.
Talk me through a little bit of the methodology. How did you go about measuring this kind of thing?
Yeah, ours is a little different. So a lot of people would have measured urban heat island, which is good because I think they all work together to kind of give us a more complete picture. Our method was a broader method, and we used a model value. And basically, the model builds in the types of design in the city. Is it dense building structure? Is it skyscrapers? Is it parkland? And then it also builds in population density. And based on those values, researchers have estimated how much additional heat that will provide to an area. And so we were able to, there's been some great research done really plotting the whole country, the land cover of the whole country. And we were able to look at all these different cities and outside of cities as well and say, this is the land cover. And based on that, this is how much additional heat there will be in this area.
So, right, your analysis looked at 65 different U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the trends that you noticed around the country?
Well, the kind of the baseline temperature we found that really existed in all the cities was 8 degrees. So that's really where all the cities had at least some measurable part of their population that was living at an area that was 8 degrees warmer than it would be otherwise if it was not for the built environment around them. And so that was kind of the big one. Some people, you know, some cities, the temperatures would go up to 10, 12 degrees, maybe even higher. But really, that 8-9 degree spot was really the sweet spot across the West. And that's a lot of heat, really, because if you're talking about 80-degree temperatures, that could mean your day feels like it's 89-90 degrees. So that, I think, would be the main finding. And knowing that more and more people live in urban environments now, there's more and more people who are going to be at risk.
Well, and you also looked at Portland, Oregon, where I am speaking to you from.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you notice about the maps of Portland?
Well, Portland there seems to be two ways that cities have their heat distributed. They have either a kind of an urban core, and the heat is really focused in the urban core. You'll see that maybe in like Chicago, I think, is a good example of that. You'll see kind of this spot in the middle, and that's where the heat is. Cleveland has that too. And then other cities tend to be more West Coast cities, Southwest cities, and some cities in Florida. The heat is more dispersed, which seems to represent a different growth pattern in those cities, and that maybe there isn't just this one urban core where everyone lives, but there's different densities around the city, different growth patterns around the city. And that's what we saw more for Portland, was some hot spots kind of scattered around the Portland area.
Obviously, urban heat islands are a big issue, and you know, we're talking now at the end of Portland's first big heat wave of the summer, where at least 6 people have died in connection to the heat wave, many of them actually in Southeast Portland. What does your research indicate to policymakers? Is that part of the conversation as well, as how to act on this kind of information?
Well, our goal is to really get the information out to the communicators of the world to help tell the story of where this is happening and how this is happening. And then hopefully the policymakers or even community organizations or citizens will pick it up and say, okay, what can we do about this now that we've realized it's not just our imagination. There's a real problem here, and there's a real issue that's making us feel hotter. I think it's easy for sometimes you say, oh, I'm just, you know, I just think I'm feeling hotter. But in these places, it truly is. And so hopefully then solutions can be targeted in a way to maybe the places that need it the most right now, and then rolled out more gradually into places that are maybe in a little better shape at this time.
You mentioned some of the things that you measured that are known to contribute to a higher urban heat island in this index. having to do with the built environment, how much paving there is. What are some of the things that, or maybe the opposite of that, that cut down on this extra heat spike?
Yeah, there's actually, this is one interesting thing about this topic, is there are solutions, and there's solutions at different scales. Say a neighborhood said, we have to take action, and we want to take action right now, and we can't wait for our city to take action. They might decide to put up something as simple as umbrellas along the street or some sort of awnings along the street to cool the street where their residents are walking or sitting or standing at the bus stop, or trees. Everyone, trees is always a favorite, but trees sometimes take longer to grow. So that's kind of one of the problems with trees. You don't always get the shade immediately, but maybe you decide to plant some trees. Maybe you decide there's a big swath of pavement. Maybe it's something that was abandoned. And it would be cooler if you made that into a community garden, say. And these things, like I said, they could be in very small size, or they could be in a bigger size where a whole city makes an effort to identify these kind of neighborhoods and spots and make these bigger changes. And then there's engineering changes, which seems to be a lot of experimentation with now. You may have heard about their painting pavement lighter colors so it's more reflective in some cities. White roofs have been popular for a while to reflect, or green roofs to also reduce the amount of heat that absorbs. So those are obviously bigger engineering solutions that are probably going to need to be done by cities or building owners. But there's a whole range, which is a really nice thing about this problem being able to be solved.
I think that it is at a stage, especially for Portland right now, where, you know, we can look to other cities who have much more of a history with intense heat. We're not really used to it here. And, you know, our built environment doesn't reflect kind of the needs of how extremely hot it's been getting.
Right. And so many of them have traditionally been built to keep us warmer. And it's just a design choice. When you're thinking, oh, what do we need from this building? We need this building to keep us warm. And now more and more months of the year, we really need to keep cool. Another advantage that places like Portland and Seattle have, that where the heat is really emerging, and if some of the systems are going into places, they can do it the right way and the best way. You know, sometimes you walk through older cities on the East Coast, there's a lot of window units that spew a lot of heat out the back of them. You know, maybe when buildings go up, or when air conditioning now is installed in buildings in the Northwest where it wasn't before, it can be done in a more efficient way, a cleaner way, a way that's not going to distribute waste heat, but a way that's also going to use the grid more efficiently and use less carbon, which is just adds to the vicious cycle of this. So there's an opportunity there for your area to kind of build into a hot zone in a better way.
Another thing that's mentioned in your research is how this urban heat is unequally distributed and how that lines up in some ways with the history of racial redlining. Can you touch on that issue a little bit?
I won't go too in depth because that was conducted by our friends at Columbia University, and they were kind enough to let us kind of have that study with ours so we could give people that additional resource. And what they looked at was cities all around the country and looked at where were the historically redlined districts, and they found in those areas that temperatures tended to be hotter than in the areas that were not historically redlined. And, you know, it varies from city to city, but it was a pattern overall across the country. So again, that may help people if they want to go in. And like you said, you know, Portland is kind of at the beginning of this thought about, you know, what are we going to do when it gets really hot? Maybe that'll help you say, these are the neighborhoods that are probably most at risk, and we should target them in our efforts.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't touch on?
I guess the only thing just to say is that because the built environment is, and population is the culprit, you can also find some hot spots outside of cities. They aren't as intense, but wherever you have intense development without cooling factors like trees or parks, you're going to have hotter spots. And so I think, you know, that's the other thing that we kind of liked about this, is we're able to kind of show that there's hot spots outside of cities too, and we need to be conscious of that, that the built environment can get you anywhere.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, thank you, and good luck in the heat.
That was Jen Brady, Senior Data Analyst at Climate Central, speaking with me about a new study out July 10th on urban heat islands. Their analysis showed that nearly 34 million U.S. residents in the nation's biggest cities live in a neighborhood where the built environment around them makes it feel 8 or more degrees hotter. More information on their research is online at climatecentral.org. Check out a map of Portland's Urban Heat Island Index on our website, KBOO.fm. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO News in Review. I'm Chris Gao. This episode is focused on health and healthcare. KBOO is in our end-of-year membership drive, and now is a great time to join. KBOO.fm/give is the website to donate. Thanks for supporting your community connection. For our last story of the hour, we're looking at another important part of healthcare, organ donation.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Sandra Tutel from the Cascade Life Alliance, here to talk about organ donation and the work that this organization does. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here today.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. So let's get into it. What is Cascade Life Alliance for people who don't know?
I am the manager of the community outreach program, which is new for Cascade Life Alliance, and two outreach coordinators that have been working with me to develop this program. We are going out to the communities. We've been to like Juneteenth, Oregon, the Delta Park powwow, the Blues Fest. We're just going to a lot of community events in order to do organ, tissue, and eye donation education. We're also, as a result of a state law that goes into effect academic year 2025, are preparing a new, very engaging, inspiring high school curriculum. So there was a 16-year-old girl, her name was Nisha, and she met with Representative Rayfield out of Corvallis, yes. And she just gave him a presentation and talked about the need for organ, eye, and tissue donation to be provided to high school students before they actually go to the driver's to the DMV to get their driver's license, when they're asked that question, you know, do you want to be an organ donor? And so he was so impressed with what she presented, and he worked with some others, and they created House Bill 3234, which states that in academic year 2025, that organ, eye, and tissue donation will be required at all Oregon high schools, usually in a health class, which would occur their first or second year of school. And so this would be before they go to the DMV. So out of that, we wanted to just really make sure that they had the proper information, that they had all the resources they need. And when I say they, I mean the teachers that are now tasked with providing this education. And then also, if they wanted someone to come into their school to do the presentation themselves, you know, that was an option. So we're currently working on putting this, you know, we're trying to build a curriculum, like I said, that is engaging, inspiring, but also like relevant to a high school student, and hopefully so they can see themselves in this situation, either having to make a decision themselves, or, you know, if they ever, you know, God forbid, do need a transplant. So we're putting this curriculum together. This will be available. We'll offer it this year.
Okay.
And just kind of, you know, find any things that need to be changed, any tweaks to the program. And if they can go online, they can fill out a form that will either request an in-person or a
the
virtual
teachers can.
Presenter. Yes, the
okay.
teachers can.
Nice.
And then, or give them all of the curriculum and all of the tools and resources they need themselves to teach it themselves. So they'll have these options. And then answer any questions. And so right now we're in the process of putting postcards together that will get sent out to all the high schools to give them this information and where they need to go. And we're also, you know, doing emails, and then even, you know, some schools that we're going to try to make sure we get into, you know, in our first year. So we'll be doing some phone calls. So we're really busy right now putting this all together and hopefully providing just something that really speaks to these students and that they'll, you know, that they'll take away and go home and talk to their families about it. And because a lot of times, you know, they don't, you know, what you might learn in school, you're not bringing home. But this is a conversation for the entire family, not just for the student themselves.
I wanted to ask about that point, though, talking about it having relevancy to high school students. What is some of the thinking about what specifically makes it relevant to high school students and thinking about that in the curriculum?
Right. Well, most people that are registered donors are registered through the DMV. So that is where the majority of people will be asked that question and take that opportunity to become a registered donor. So we want to make sure that you have all the information beforehand and answer any, you know, if there's any misconceptions or confusion, and just make sure they really understand what they're being asked. And our job is not to push them, you know, pressure them into signing up, but just making sure they have all the information they need to make an informed choice on that.
Yeah.
And so the reason for high school is because of really the age of getting your driver's license and going in. But you can register in a variety of ways. You can register on your iPhone health app. There's registerme.org. But most people do register through the DMV.
Yeah. Is there, when thinking about organ donation and matching folks up with a potential donor, is age a factor in that?
No, there's a lot of criteria in matching the organ donor to the recipient, but age is not. So we just had a 98-year-old man that donated his liver and was placed into a 72-year-old woman who was doing quite well. So a lot of times people feel like they're too old, or, you know, they've had a hard life and that nobody would want, you know, their organs. But the reality is anyone can register to be a donor. And you would be really surprised who actually, you know, can qualify to donate their organs. And if it's not organs, it's corneas and tissue. This enhances the lives of hundreds of people. You know, an organ donor can save the lives up to 8 people, but you can also, you know, improve the health of hundreds of people through tissue and cornea donation. So a person should just, you know, realize that regardless of their age or health conditions, that there is a likelihood that they can, you know, leave the legacy of a donation, be it organ or tissue. Or
eye. Yeah. Well, what are some of the statistics? Like, how many people are signed up for this kind of thing in Oregon?
Yeah. So in the state of Oregon, we have over 3 million registered donors, which seems like a huge amount, right? So in the country, there are over 100,000 people on the transplant waiting list. So it seems like with those kind of numbers, this shouldn't be a problem. But it is actually very difficult to be an organ donor. It's an incredibly complex process. Mm-hmm. And so the likelihood of being an organ donor is pretty low. So that's why you need to have such huge numbers of people registered to be donors. Right now, with the waiting list, about 60% of the transplant waiting list are people from communities of color, and about 30% of registered donors are from the same communities of color. And this is really important to address this, because the matching of an organ donor with a recipient is much improved when they are from the same race. And so when you have better matching, you have better outcomes. And you have, you know, better transplant outcomes, and you have longer lasting grafts, which of course is very important. And so we're just really trying. August is the National Multi-Ethnic Donor Awareness Month, and it's a really great opportunity to talk about these numbers and actually why these numbers exist. You know, people from communities of color often have higher numbers of health conditions such as diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. And these conditions did not come out of nowhere. There's reasons for these health conditions, and it can be years of discrimination, inadequate access, and discriminatory healthcare policies. And so we want to have those honest conversations and talk about that, and talk about why that need is so large, and also address that need. And that's by increasing the number of registered donors is going to increase the likelihood of receiving a transplant from somebody of the same race, and which has proven to have better outcomes.
As you're doing this work out in the community, are there misconceptions that you encounter?
So one of them is, you know, they're concerned that the doctor won't try to save their lives. And other ones include that I'm too old. I've had this illness. I've had cancer. I had, you know, this, you know, health event that they feel would eliminate their chances of being an organ donor. And we just always say register. Just register. Because, like I said, there's also cornea and tissue that enhances the lives of hundreds of others. But, you know, our medical professionals will know. They know your medical history. They're going to go over, you know, your records. They're going to do tests. I mean, you just might really be surprised on who ends up being an organ donor. So if you have an opportunity to give this amazing gift of life and have that legacy and you know, saving lives, like, you take that opportunity. And also, we have a lot of families that report that knowing that their loved one was a donor and is leaving that legacy really, you know, brought them some comfort during the most horrible time of their life. And it helped with that healing. And a lot of families are volunteers because of that interaction with other people that receive transplants, knowing that their loved one was part of that is really, you know, really quite amazing for them. And so there's just a lot of good reasons, you know, to do this. And if there's concerns, you know, there's always, you know, places to get that information and to ask those questions and, you know, address those concerns. But yeah, there's, I'm trying to think off the top of my head some of the other misconceptions of, usually it's around age or people are, you know, some people are concerned about religious beliefs, and most major, all major religions support organ donation and see it as an act of generosity and love, you know, end of life. Some people are concerned about open casket funerals, which are completely possible with organ, eye, and tissue donation. It doesn't affect that. I mean, there's a lot. But if you go to our website, which is cascadelifealliance.org, you know, we address all of those and, you know, give the answers and give links to other resources that if you want to research that further.
Mm-hmm. So to circle back, can you tell me a little bit about the process of how organ and tissue donation works?
Yes. So at Cascade Life Alliance, we are one of 56 federally designated organ procurement organizations in the country, and we service, our designated service area includes the state of Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Southwest Idaho. Mm-hmm. And we are the organization that receives referrals when somebody is a potential organ donor after all measures have been taken to save that person's life. And we then go out to the hospitals. We, you know, review charts, review records, and see, you know, determine the potential of that person being an organ donor. If it is determined that they are eligible, we then have staff that are trained in providing support to families and giving them the information about organ donation as an option, answering their questions, and just, you know, really doing what they need to do to support that family. If the family authorizes donation or if the person is a registered donor, the organ procurement, that's when they look at the national waiting list, the database, and start to find these matches. And like I said before, matches are based on a lot of criteria, so it's not a real simple, you know, thing to do. So while they're looking at the database, doing tasks, you know, finding the best match, the transplant team is preparing to procure organs once those matches are found. So then transplant surgeons will come to the OR. They will procure the organs. They will oftentimes then do cornea and tissue. And then our perfusion team comes in and takes care of the very time-sensitive transporting of these organs to the transplant centers where the identified recipients are living at. So organs stay within the state of Oregon or a designated service area, but they also go to other places based upon who is a match, and also location and time. And there's just, you know, it's a very complex process. So that's what Cascade Life Alliance does. And we also now are really focused on providing that education to the community and to the high schools.
Mm-hmm. If listeners are interested in finding out more information, what do you recommend?
So if you want to register to be a donor, if you want to get right to that, you can go to registerme.org. You can go to your DMV, have that added to your driver's license. You can go to our website, which is CascadeLifeAlliance.org. And on every page, there's a button to be a registered donor. If you want to learn more about the high school curriculum that we're developing or the community outreach events that we're attending, if you want to request a speaker, you go to CascadeLifeAlliance.org/outreach, and all of our contact information is on there.
Very cool. Well, Sandra, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
I appreciate the time very much. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to KBOO News in Review. This episode was focused on health and healthcare. A big thank you to all the KBOO volunteers and staff that have made the KBOO News possible this past year. And thank you for listening and supporting KBOO. If you haven't yet, it's not too late. Go online to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution. For KBOO News, I am Chris Gow. Thank you for being with us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We know a KBOO membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season.